I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Two brothers, James Weldon Johnson and John Rosamond Johnson, wrote the song Lift Every Voice and Sing in 1900 to commemorate what would have been President Lincoln's 91st birthday. It was sung by schools and church choirs at social and civic organizations, and in a few decades became known as the Black National Anthem. Our guest Imani Perry says the song was a, quote, ritual bridge between the political and the spiritual dimensions of Black social life that were so often deeply connected. Her new book is May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. She writes about the Johnson brothers and how this song was sung by different artists over the years to celebrate, to protest, to mourn, and mark significant events. She joins us on Radio Times to explain what this anthem reveals about our history, especially with today's heated arguments about the Star-Spangled Banner. She's the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and joins us once again on Radio Times. Imani Perry, nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You chose, we asked you, who's your favorite singer of Lift Every Voice and Sing, and you chose Esther Satterfield from
yes.
a 1974 album, Once I Love. Tell us why you love this version, and we'll play a portion of it.
I love it because it's jubilant and it's optimistic. It has the energy of the 1970s in it, right? The kind of sense of possibility of that period. And it's also the version I played on the record player all the time when I was a little girl. You know, usually I sang it with community groups, but this was a song that I listened to frequently in this version.
Well, let's give it a listen.
Lift every voice and sing. Till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark has.
Esther Satterfield, Lift Every Voice and Sing from the 1974 album Once I Loved. And our guest Imani Perry says her favorite version of this song, and that's what her book is about. You begin this book with your little son
yes.
humming this tune. And you ask him, where did you learn that?
Right, yes.
You were surprised to hear him?
I was. He had learned it at a private Quaker school. The school that was predominantly white. I was surprised that he learned it in that context because, of course, my experience of the song is overwhelmingly in Black community contexts. And I asked him, you know, where did you learn it? He said, at school. I said, do you know what it is? He said, yes, the Black National Anthem. And then we went home to my home in Alabama for the holidays, for Thanksgiving, and I asked him to stand up and sing the song, which is sort of a commonplace Black Southern practice to have children perform.
Oh, is that? I did
yes.
not know that. Okay.
So I asked him to stand up and sing, and the entirety of my family stood up with him and sang with him and raised their fists, and his eyes were like saucers in response, and it was really powerful for him to actually have a moment where he understood through this performance together the meaning of the song. It's very different than simply explaining to someone, you know, this is an important song, but the action of what it meant to understand what it meant to sing together. was really powerful.
Did you do that as a little girl with your family? Was it a song that was sung together?
No, I can't think of any specific instances. It was usually in my experience. It was usually sort of celebratory occasions, like, you know, the annual Martin Luther King Jr. breakfast or Black History Month programs or, you know, Kwanzaa or those type of events. But I didn't tend to sing it at home, although I played that version. We just listened to it at home all the time. But that sense of community was always central to my experience of the song.
Why did these brothers write the song? What was the inspiration for them? And I should add that James was the lyricist,
yes,
and John was the composer.
Yes. So these, the Johnson brothers were what were called racemen of the period, right, as well as Renaissance men. So they were highly accomplished. But they had been socialized to think everything that they did that was of importance was for the race, right, and for uplift, so collective uplift. And we have to understand that this is a period in which that the historian Rayford Logan referred to as the nadir of American race relations, mm-hmm, right? So the possibilities of Reconstruction were destroyed. Lynching comes. Segregation is legalized, right? So it's in some ways the lowest point. You know, the promise of the Civil War has been denied. But you have also in this period this remarkable development of organizations, of organizing, of pursuing education, of pursuing political goals, all these things that are happening in Black communities. So the song really captures the energy of that turn of the century moment. And that's really why I think it grows almost immediately, right? The sense of striving that is so intensive in Black Southern communities.
And the first segment of it is optimistic and celebratory.
Yes.
The second is more about the past. It's about suffering.
Yes.
And the third is a much more sort of reverent, religious part of the song. There isn't any mention there of race per se.
Right.
Or the United States,
that's
per
right.
se.
That's right. Yes. And I think that's important. I mean, on the one hand, the way that I read the song is part of what it does is it tells the story of Black life in epic terms. It makes it, it talks about Black people in sort of grand terms, universal terms. And this is important because this is a people that are deemed as not having any history, right, of any significance, right? And it's also important to not name a specific nation, because you have to think about in the context of empire, really, kind of all these European empires, there are actually very few, you know, there's Haiti and Liberia, there are very few Black nations. And so it really is a way of expressing a kind of patriotism that isn't bound to any of these places that actually deny the citizenship of Black people all over the world, but that really fashions a patriotism from values and from the story, like a story of struggle that isn't about the nation state itself.
Well, yeah. It's interesting how this becomes appropriated, I guess, as the black national,
yes,
anthem. And the NAACP does in a sense pronounce it, but you also say it was promoted by the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs even,
yes,
before that.
Absolutely. So it was which included a lot of Black women teachers, organizers. I mean, it was really important that the proliferation of the song happened almost immediately. I mean, in the 1910s, through the labor of Black women organizers. And the Johnson brothers really didn't envision the song as a Black anthem. I mean, it sort of happened. I mean, what's incredible is it happened organically. It's just sort of spread. And Victoria Earle Matthews, who was a Black woman public intellectual, and then in the 1910s, really almost immediately started referring to it as an anthem.
Oh, interesting. Not a song, but an anthem.
An anthem. It's interesting. So it was referred to first as, kind of collectively, as the National Negro Hymn, and then the National Negro Anthem, and then sort of it progresses. And actually, the NAACP has always rejected the idea of calling it the Black National Anthem officially, because the organization saw itself as, look, we're trying to be fully included in the United States. We don't want to call this you know, there's only one national anthem. And yet when they adopt it as their official song, there is a way that they're reaching out to a black public that has said, this is our anthem, and saying, yes, we're connected with that vision.
Well, you include something that James Johnson said. He said, there's nothing in Lift Every Voice and Sing to conflict in the slightest degree with the use of the Star Spangled Banner or American. He says it's as patriotic as those songs. But then he goes on to say, and I think people would agree with him, it, certainly in terms of singing this song, the music of the Star Spangled Banner is derived from old foreign drinking songs, difficult to sing. In addition, the sentiments are boastful and bloodthirsty. Words of Lift Every Voice are more elevated in spirit. I do not hesitate to say my brother's music is better than either of these imported songs.
Yes. Yeah.
He was a proud composer.
Yes, he was a proud composer. And there's debates. I mean, that's part of a debate over the song and whether, you know, that happened amongst black intellectuals. Should there be an anthem or not? And then what one of the things I think is interesting, though, is before the Star Spangled Banner is adopted as the national anthem of the United States, Lift Every Voice and Sing has been adopted by black Americans, which I think is fascinating. You know, we don't even have as a nation an official anthem until the mid-30s.
And by adopted, it sounds like what you're saying is that it was
sung. It was referred to as the – pasted in the back of church programs, circulated, you know, in one of the things that I loved in terms of the research is going through graduation programs of all these different types of schools. And so it's written as the National Negro Hymn or the National Negro Anthem in high school and college graduation programs, elementary school programs all throughout the South, beginning in the 19-teens.
More in the South than the North?
Much more in the South. I mean, you know, this is also sort of before you have the Great Migration really shifting the demographics of black America. But also part of the story is that segregation actually facilitated the creation of these black institutions, both schools but also all kinds of civic organizations. So there was a sort of, you know, world within a world. So it is more in the South because of that.
We're almost having a break here, but and this is just a sort of a remarkable transformation, but you write between, I think, 1910 and 1930 or somewhere in the 20s and 30s, something like 1.5 million African Americans move from the rural parts of the country to the cities.
Yes.
Did that change this song?
Well, what it does, I think, is you know, seeing urbanization allows for the creation of a lot more different types of institutions, right? So that to not be attached to the plantation economy. So for me, the migration of the urban South is actually as important as the migration North. Yeah, so that's one of the important pieces.
I'm going to pick up on that. Okay. That's Imani Perry, our guest on Radio Times today. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, and author of a new book, May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. And we'll be playing a number of versions of Lift Every Voice and Sing during the hour. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Imani Perry about this song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, composed by two brothers in 1900 and became known as the Black National Anthem. I do want to play another version, and this is the Tuskegee University Golden Voices Concert Choir performing Lift Every Voice and Sing in 2017.
Lift every voice and sing,
lift every voice and sing.
Tuskegee University Golden Voices Concert Choir, their version of Lift Every Voice and Sing. Imani, I was looking at you as you were listening to that.
Yeah.
What were you hearing?
I mean, it's a beautiful version. It also makes me sentimental because I come from a Tuskegee University family. Most of my aunts and uncles attended Tuskegee. And so that sense of history with that particular institution is very powerful for me.
Yeah. You mentioned that within the Black community at this time in the early 20th century, there was, I guess, a debate, an argument about this song, but also what this song represented. And you do include a parody, and I guess it was parodied.
Yeah.
The communists, or certain people who were communists at the mm-hmm. time, did not care for this mm-hmm. song, which they saw as the official song of the NAACP.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Here's a version, George B. Murphy. Lift every voice and sing till communism rings, rights with the true Soviet liberty. Let our revolting rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Yeah.
So does this represent some kind of a argument within Black leadership at the time?
Sure. And George B. Murphy was a communist and a member of the Murphy family. He's actually my children's great-great uncle.
Is he really? Yeah, oh, my goodness.
On the other side of his
family.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. And so in some ways he was critiquing the mainstream, in that moment critiquing the NAACP for not taking the stronger stands on social issues that the Communist Party would touch. For example, the Scottsboro Boys case. You know, there were cases that the NAACP shied away from in terms of defending Black people because they thought it sort of would tarnish the image of Black America. So the parody is actually a way of kind of commenting that the limitations of some of the civil rights organizations on pushing for justice.
An email from Paul, he says, back in the 1980s, I was a company pianist for the New Jersey Ballet. We did many ballet demonstrations for schools. One in Newark, New Jersey, I was asked to play Lift Every Voice and Sing to be sung by all the kids and teachers before our program. I'm a white guy. I didn't know the piece, so they gave me the music. I was so taken by the tune and text that to this day I can play it from memory. And I mean, it's a beautiful,
it's beautiful
song.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful song.
It is. It really is.
Paul, thanks for that comment. And you can comment as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I want to know a little bit more about these brothers. They lived
sure.
in Jacksonville, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, they were what sounds like solidly middle class, at least for African Americans
at the time.
Born in the 1870s, so
yes.
after the Civil War.
Yes, and their mother was Bahamian. Their father was a Virginian. Their parents had met in New York, actually. And went to the Bahamas in the midst of the Civil War because they were fearful that if the South won the Civil War, that slavery would move north.
Oh.
And so then they come back, they come to Florida after the war. And I think for me this is an important point because, the Bahamas had almost like a proto-Jim Crow society already. And so part of the idea was that Jacksonville, Florida would have more freedom than the Bahamas in that period. And because it was a tourist town, there was less racial violence because people didn't want, lynchings to happen where they were vacationing, essentially. Yeah, yeah. And so as a consequence, there was, it was a less kind of hostile environment. But certainly, they still suffered from a kind of Jim Crow society. They had to go away to go to high school. There wasn't a high school for them in Jacksonville. And they left Jacksonville really because after a major fire that the city let sort of burn down the Black community, they thought there weren't that many options for them, and they moved up to New York. Yeah.
And John, who was the composer, he studied at the New England Conservatory.
He did,
and also
yes,
in London.
Yeah, he was an extraordinary composer. Operas, various kinds of shows, as well as popular music, as well as classical music. I mean, really kind of extraordinary. He deserves his own book, honestly.
Really?
Although James is known more because he was also a poet and a novelist. But Rosamond, he was called Rosamond, was similarly accomplished.
And they composed songs for Tin Pan Alley.
They did.
I mean, very different.
Yes, totally different. They had just an extraordinary range, which I think actually for me is important to include those details, because even though the book is mostly about the social history of the song, the range actually captures something important for me, which is that Black community life was, like all community life, varied. You know, there's the formal, there's the vernacular, there's the like ritual, and then there's the kind of relaxed everyday living. And we have to, it's important for scholars to figure out ways to show the entirety of it. We're very good at showing the kind of the vernacular, the kind of, you know, blues, juke joint, you know, kind of world, but not so much the formal world outside of church life. And so part of what I wanted to do is, you know, the reason they could move between all these is because that's what their lives were like. Right. They moved between different forms of social activity.
Whether it was the NAACP or other civic social organizations.
Right.
And that was that more for a more well to do?
No, and I think that's actually a really important point, is that, you know, there were certainly bourgeois organizations, but what I call Black formalism, like Black formal life, existed across the socioeconomic spectrum and, and had to, because the reality is the Black middle class at that point was so tiny. Right. I mean, the Black working class and the Black poor really were the huge bulk of the community, and they built these institutions.
It's so interesting whether these institutions were built in response to, as you say, the segregation, the rise of the KKK, Jim Crow. So you've got these forces, in a sense, working against each other.
Right. And the thing that I think there's the part of how they're working against each other is, right, so that the society's doors are closed. But there's also something that's really profound about emancipation, which is it's a moment when people who were enslaved get to imagine how they want to structure their society, right? That most people don't go through that kind of transition, right, to be wholly excluded from a kind of formal social political world to how are we going to fashion this, right? And so that even though the country sort of abandons and fails Black Americans after Reconstruction, there's still that sense of vision, right, that people are pushing forward and really sort of in some ways take advantage of the exclusion to sort of do their own thing in many ways. It's just really profound.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Imani Perry. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's been a guest on Radio Times over the years and joins us in this Radio Times to talk about her new book, May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. And we've been playing versions of Lift Every Voice and Sing, again, composed by two brothers back in 1900 to mark what would have been President Lincoln's 91st birthday. But this is a song that has been used ever since to both commemorate events, to mourn events, and to celebrate events. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. I cannot believe it's been 50 years, but I remember that day very, very well. You do talk about this song and what it meant, I guess, to Martin Luther King, and also how he used it and it was used around him.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that was really, as I was researching, that really got to me was, you know, and hit me in my heart, is that the first public speech he ever delivered, which was for the Colored Elks Club in Georgia, which his father was a member of, and that's one of the kind of civic organizations I talk about. And it was a speech titled The Negro and the Constitution. And he quotes Lift Every Voice and Sing in the speech. What you see over the course of his life when reading his sermons or listening to his sermons is that he returns to it. He makes reference to it. And it's a way of – one of the ways that he connects with the community that he's ministering to, that he's organizing with. And it also – I find really profound is that he repeatedly cites the second verse in the most difficult moments of the movement, right? So after deaths, after defeats. He goes to that verse, which is really about endurance through the darkest days. So it's part of the kind of archive for him. And I think that's profound, because oftentimes we act as though something totally new happened in the 50s and 60s. And really, I think that the song and the world that produced it prepares people to become those who will be the civil rights warriors.
The second verse goes like this: "Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yet with a steady beat, have not our weary feet come to the place for which our fathers sighed. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered. Out from the glory past, till now we stand at last where the white gleam of our bright star is cast." Mm-hmm. I mean, those are really beautiful, moving words. You also write about the fact that when he's, quote, he's giving a speech, I think in Atlanta again, and he's quoting "My Country, 'Tis of Thee," the
yes.
words. And the pianist, while he's saying the words, the pianist begins to play "Lift Every Voice and Sing." Do we
mm-hmm,
have that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's various moments like that. And they happen throughout history where people, where there's a sort of mix of these patriotic sort of Americana songs broadly with "Lift Every Voice and Sing." So sometimes it is a sort of an alternative. And then sometimes there's a blend, which I think actually in some ways captures the story or the saga of Black Americans anyway, right? I mean, you know, sort of, you know, that dance between obviously being deeply and profoundly American, but also often being excluded.
Well, let me play something. This is Renee Marie,
mm-hmm.
And this is at the Denver State of the City Address. This goes back, I think, to 2008.
Yes.
She was asked to sing the national anthem, and instead she used the words from "Lift Every Voice and Sing," but sang the melody from "The Star-Spangled Banner." Let's give that a listen.
Let our rejoicings rise.
Victory is won, to close that
yes.
out. She got in trouble for that. It kind of
yes.
works in a weird way.
It does. I mean, she has a beautiful voice. It
she
works.
Does.
She got in trouble because this was right before the Democratic National Convention in Denver, right, where President Obama was going to get the Democratic Party nomination. And if, you know, if we remember, there were all these questions about, you know, can he be president of, you know, or can he represent all of the United States? Will he just care about Black people in this? So there was a lot of anxiety that she was messing things up for Obama by bringing in this Black national anthem. And he was asked about it, and he said if she was asked to sing the Star Spangled Banner, that's what she should have sang, and, you know, was really kind of disengaged from it. So it really captured that moment in history. Yeah.
Well, it's here we are in a time and place where we're arguing about the national anthem.
Oh, all over again. Yes.
Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, because as part of, you know, doing the research on the history of this song, you know, I encountered earlier moments in which the Star Spangled Banner, in moments of protest, the Star Spangled Banner became this a representation of protest of racial injustice. All right. So if we think of Colin Kaepernick's kneeling for the Star Spangled Banner, you know that there were other events in the 1970s, for example, that are very similar to that. And the way in all of these occasions, right, Lift Every Voice and Sing has sort of emerged as an alternative or as a kind of critique of the Star Spangled Banner as a the failure of the country to live up to its promises of equality.
And it has some problem words.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yes.
In the Star Spangled Banner.
Right, yeah. I mean, like a constitution. I mean, we can't run away from our history.
No, we can't. We can't run away from a break in the show either. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Imani Perry. We're talking about this song and playing versions of it, Lift Every Voice and Sing Again, written by two brothers back in 1900, and has become known as the Black National Anthem. And our guest, Imani Perry, who's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, has written all about this, what this song reveals to us about our history, about a time and a place. And her book is called May We Forever Stand. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. More music and conversation after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Imani Perry about Lift Every Voice and Sing, come to be known as the Black National Anthem. We were talking about the Star Spangled Banner right before the break, and I did yesterday because I was just curious. I wanted to revisit Roseanne singing the National Anthem. This was 1990. I was horrified. Yeah. I mean, she completely butchers that song, and then when it's over, she spits and grabs her crotch.
Yeah,
just to sort of quite add vulgar insult to injury. So what struck me is here we are at a time when people are kneeling to protest police brutality and police violence.
Mm-hmm.
They are not spitting or grabbing their crotch.
No, of course. I mean,
or butchering the song,
and it's a form of patriotism. I mean, you know, one can, you know, have a debate over sort of the contours of patriotism or the content, but certainly. You know, dissent is written into a constitution, and it's written into the fabric of the nation. In some ways, it's at the foundation. And so, this idea that a form of dissent that's about a claim to equality and citizenship is unacceptable, and yet a complete kind of vulgar desecration of the song as the national anthem is okay, is frankly, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It's indefensible, honestly.
Let me see what looks like Bonnie from Philadelphia has to say. Bonnie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just have to give my comment, which is 30 years ago as an adult, I learned Lift Every Voice and Sing. I'm from Lily White America from years ago, not anymore, which is great. And some of my coworkers, my African-American coworkers, were like, oh, come on. They hadn't heard of it.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I learned it at the Unitarian Universalist don't belong with them anymore, but they had a great choir, the Unitarians in Philadelphia, and it's from Singing in the Living Tradition that I just took it out. I'm like, I love that song. It's so, you know, empowering is an overused word, but that's what it is. You know, it's wonderful. So thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Bonnie. Thanks for your call. Anything you want to say?
Yeah, Bonnie? I mean, I'm so glad that you said that, Bonnie, because one of the things that I write about is that, you know, as African Americans, as Americans in general, no longer belong to kind of associations and organizations in the same way. I call it, you know, the loss of associational life, as Alexis de Tocqueville, you know, described it. Black, you know, American associationalism was really big. That's kind of fallen by the wayside in our lives, and as a consequence, a younger generation of African Americans are less likely to learn the song because they no longer belong to the kind of organizations where you'd sing it in a kind of ritual fashion. That combined with desegregation means that there's lots of people who haven't learned the song, or if they, or may know about the song but don't know the words, or in some cases don't even know about the song.
A tweet from Nathan, he said, I grew up recognizing Lift Every Voice and Sing as the Black National Anthem, and my grandparents prided themselves on knowing all three verses, which is quite a feat, given that none of the lyrics are repeated. The Melba Moore All-Star version of Lift Every Voice and Sing was iconic to me as a kid. I still listen to it every day.
Yeah, that was a 96 recording. That was actually fairly successful, which is interesting because it was late, and there was a nice music video with it, and
Are you trying to bring it back, bring back the song by writing this book?
You know, I'm not, which is sort of like the big surprise at the end of the book. What I'm trying to bring back, or what I think is important, is the meaning of being in community, singing together, and a set of shared values that I think if we want to continue the struggles for justice of various sorts, we actually have to commit to community. And part of the benefit of singing together is it deepens a sense of community. So it doesn't have to be Lift Every Voice and Sing. I love the song. I think it's beautiful. I love the history. But we need things like that in our lives now, particularly now, given all of the crises that we're facing.
I wonder, and this was a song written in 1900, so it's more than 100 years old, whether during the civil rights movement of the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s and beyond, whether We Shall Overcome sort of overcame Lift Every Voice.
Yes, it did. In the 60s, We Shall Overcome and to a lesser extent other freedom songs like We Shall Not Be Moved in some ways displaced Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was often the song that people sang at protests before. The freedom songs made sense in the context of that movement, one, because lots of people were coming, lots of students were coming from the North, black and white students who didn't necessarily know Lift Every Voice and Sing. But also the freedom songs were easy to learn, easy to improvise on. You didn't need instrumental music to go along with them at all, you know. And so they displaced Lift Every Voice and Sing for a while. But then Lift Every Voice and Sing really comes back with the turn to the Black Power movement, which is fascinating. And in some sense, that's, you know, again, a moment of turning inward, building institutions, much like the turn of the century.
But you don't, I mean, this is probably a gross generalization here, but it doesn't feel like a Black Power song, if you know what I mean. I mean, in many ways it is. Embedded in this is about Black Power, but it's not.
Well,
overt.
Yes. Well, I think for me, you know, and I have all these sort of various intentions with the book is actually to give a more robust picture of the period of the late 60s and 70s. Because I think, you know, we talk about Black Power, but we tend not to talk about Black consciousness. And so much of that period was about sort of consciousness and community building and like sort of learn. And a lot of it was about learning history. Right, recuperating the past. And so the song becomes part of that, right? So it's not, the Panthers have their own anthem. It's not a Black Panther anthem.
Right, no.
But for lots of the, you know, lots of other sort of Black organizations that are thinking about both returning to an African past, but they talk a lot about the past in the Deep South in that period too and sort of blend those things. And the song becomes part of that fabric.
Let me read some more comments. Lou in Allentown, the anthem Lift Every Voice and Sing has been in several editions of the Lutheran Book of Worship over the past years. Even us old Lutherans sing it with gusto and energy. Mm-hmm. I mean, do we see it more in hymnals now? Or does it also live in hymnals?
It does also live in hymnals. It is in, I think, the Black Catholic hymnal, too. It's very, yes, so it has a life in hymnals and always did. I mean, sort of was pasted in the back of hymnals before it became officially part of hymnals. It has had a presence in church. So the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, for example, they sing it regularly as I think every year is part of Black History Month. So there is that, the kind of liturgical presence as well. Yeah.
An email from, I think it's Corinne. I'm so thankful to hear today's program. I've sung this song in a Unitarian Universalist congregation.
So
I didn't know its history. The story of the song adds to its beauty and impact. An email from Mary in Arden, Delaware. Renee Marie's version of on her album, Voice of My Beautiful Country, her version is daring and quite moving.
Mm-hmm.
You'd agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Let me get, looks like Virginia from Broomall. Virginia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, I'm an elderly white lady who taught for many years in the Philadelphia schools, and the schools I worked in were primarily black. And I learned to sing Lift Every Voice. I had never heard it before an assembly, and so I've been singing along with the radio.
Oh, that's good to know.
That's lovely.
Virginia, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We've been playing a number of versions, and I want to play another one. This was at Barack Obama's inaugural benediction, or I should say inauguration, first inauguration in 2009. And this is the benediction by the Reverend Dr. Joseph E. Lowery. He doesn't sing the first verse, but he says it. Let's give it a listen.
God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, Thou who has brought us thus far along the way, Thou who has by thy might led us into the light, keep us forever in the path, we pray. Lest our feet stray from the places, our God, where we met thee, lest our hearts drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee. Shadowed beneath thy hand, may we forever stand true to thee, O God, and true to our native land.
And that's the third verse. So
yes.
We will have heard all three verses during this hour. And again, very powerful, very religious, if I can put it that way.
Yes. And which is also interesting because James was not a believer, James Weldon Johnson. That moment... I can say, I think for me, and I'd say it's also for many African Americans, at least of a certain age, was really profound because, and it was the moment in the inauguration where I wept because it was a kind of covert citation. The majority of the public didn't know what he was doing. And he cites the verse that's about not losing one's way, right? Lest our feet, stray from the places, our God, where we met thee, right? Drunk with the wine of the world, we forget. You know, so it's a reminder. Reverend Lowery, who, was a civil rights organizer, a member of SCLC, saying the struggle continues, right? So this is an extraordinary transformation, but the struggle continues. And so it was a message to Black America in the midst of the inauguration, also in the midst of a campaign where race was such a touchy subject. So I found that, it was really quite a profound moment.
I mean, it's interesting that he was sending maybe a message more to Black America
yes.
than to white America.
Yes, absolutely, in that moment. Yeah.
Comment from Byron. He says, my most recent mass singing of the song was before a screening of the Black Panther movie.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow, is right. Singing Lift Every Voice and Sing before seeing Black Panther.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I don't quite know. It's interesting because the Black Panther, the way that it has operated as a kind of cultural signifier, I mean, I'm not surprised because it's sort of this mix of past and present and future possibility and imagination.
Yeah, maybe at the end more than the beginning,
right?
Nonetheless.
Fascinating.
So what happened to James and John Johnson?
James goes on to really become sort of a father of the Harlem Renaissance. I mean, he worked for the NAACP as the Secretary General, and then New York really sort of ushers in the body of young writers who sort of transform African American literature. And Rosamond continues as a composer. Rosamond's daughter actually founds a school in New York that one of my students actually was a graduate of that school.
Right.
But I find it a great kind of history because the Modern School was one of the schools that continued to sing the song until it closed a few years ago. But so they're sort of these figures who move through all these walks of life, but James says at the end of his life that he understands that this song is the most significant accomplishment of his life, which is extraordinary. He's the first Black person admitted to the bar, lawyer in Florida, and he's principal and he's a novelist, but that they understand the significance of this one piece.
You told me before going on the air that you had the most fun doing this book. It's been a number of years coming.
Yes. No, I've never – I mean, being in the archive and looking through newspapers and graduation programs and memoirs. And I mean, literally these thousands of documents of all these sort of beautiful ritual occasions, you know, and some of them are these moments where you like you see people and they're literally looking into cotton fields, but they're singing, you know, living less than hand to mouth, right? And then they're singing this extraordinary song of possibility. It just, for me, is so moving. Mm. And it also was so pleasurable, you know, to just the scope and the imagination. Like, it just gave, you know, repeatedly gave me chills and made me excited. And every day I was excited to go in the archives. The hard part was figuring out what to put in the book, you know, because I couldn't
always,
put the majority.
Always.
Yeah. So it's really fun.
A tweet from Aaron. He says, the song was written by my fraternity brother. It's a part of our history and legacy. That's one of the first things we were taught, and we continue to teach it to youth groups.
Yes, he must be an alpha phi
okay.
fraternity.
Okay, all right. Yes. I never joined a fraternity or a sorority.
Yeah.
So where can you see the future of this song?
So it's interesting. In some ways, I want it to avoid seeing the future, but it is fascinating that it keeps reappearing.
Right.
You know, it comes up. It came up in Ferguson. It came up in, you know, in the context of Kaepernick's protests. And so there's something about the song that is really resilient. And that, to me, is profound. I don't know if it will eventually kind of fade away. And part of my impulse was also like I didn't want it to fade away without a kind of comprehensive description of what it has been and what it's meant.
Well, even just the couple of versions that we heard in this hour, everyone who sings it, and we're almost out, and we're going to have Ray Charles take
yes.
us out, but it's different. It sounds different. It feels different.
It's so interesting because recorded versions vary, but there's very little variation in group performances. So group performances tend to be very faithful to one or two arrangements, but the performers, especially post-1960 performers, really experiment with it, which I think is a way that musicians like experiment with questions around identity and race and the future.
Well, Imani Perry, I always enjoy talking with you. Thank you so much for joining
you.
Us today on Radio Times. The book is May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. And again, she's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and as promised, this is Ray Charles on The Dick Cavett Show, singing Lift Every Voice from 1972.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah, and I want to
sing along.
Lift every voice and sing, tell her then heaven rang with the heart.